from the Radio Catskill Studios in Liberty, New York. This is Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. On today's show, a new fight to protect voter privacy. The League of Women Voters of New York State is stepping in to block what they call a federal overreach by the U.S. Department of Justice. It's demanding access to the state's full voter database, including sensitive personal information. We'll speak live with the executive director of the League of Women Voters of New York State about what's at stake for voters and election integrity. Emergency calls are rising, volunteers are disappearing. EMS leaders in Damascus, Pennsylvania warn that care in rural communities is at a breaking point. NYU Dentistry is backed and helping out the Center for Discovery. And a classic art form with a scientific twist. We hear from artist Mia Brownell ahead of her exhibition at Catskill Art Space after the news from NPR.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. President Trump says he's largely reached a trade deal with South Korea. He's wrapped up talks for the day on his trip to an Asian economic summit. No details of a deal have been released, but South Korea says the U.S. will lower tariffs on autos and that Seoul will invest hundreds of billions of dollars in the U.S. President Trump will discuss trade again tomorrow when he meets China's president. House Speaker Mike Johnson says he's talked with the president about the possibility of Trump seeking a third term in the White House. The speaker, a constitutional lawyer, says he sees no constitutional path for Trump to do that. Trump was asked about this on his trip, and he said the Constitution does not permit him to be president again.
I have the best numbers for any president in many years, any president. And I would say that if you read it, it's pretty clear. I'm not allowed to run. Stupid.
Trump has previously made jokes about seeking a third term in the White House. A federal trial gets underway today in Oregon. It's over one lawsuit that challenges President Trump's ability to deploy members of the National Guard in the city of Portland. From Oregon Public Broadcasting, Conrad Wilson reports.
The trial is before the same judge who blocked the deployment earlier this month. U.S. District Court Judge Karen Emmergett will examine whether the law and Constitution give the president the authority to deploy the National Guard, or whether those efforts in Portland infringe on the state's rights. Attorneys for the Trump administration argued the president has the authority to federalize and deploy the Oregon National Guard. The city of Portland, along with the states of Oregon and California, say when Congress wrote the law, it was clear the president should only call up the National Guard as a last resort. For NPR News, I'm Conrad Wilson in Portland.
Separately, a federal appeals court has voted to rehear a related lawsuit. The Ninth U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals will review a different ruling by the same judge. The ruling also involves the potential deployment of National Guard troops in Oregon. Stocks opened higher this morning as investors watch for the Federal Reserve's expected move on interest rates. NPR's Scott Horsley reports the Dow Jones Industrial Average jumped about 250 points in early trading.
The Federal Reserve is expected to cut its benchmark interest rate by a quarter percentage point this afternoon. It made a similar cut 6 weeks ago. The Fed's hoping to add some juice to the flagging job market, but timely measures of that market have been hampered by the federal government shutdown. Computer chip darling NVIDIA's stock rose after the company announced another $500 billion worth of orders for its artificial intelligence chips. NVIDIA is now the first corporation in history with a market value of $5 trillion. Boeing reported better-than-expected sales during the most recent quarter, but the jetmaker's still losing money. The adjusted loss per share for the quarter was $7.47. Scott Horsley, NPR News, Washington.
You're listening to NPR News from Washington. The National Hurricane Center says Hurricane Melissa has lost a lot of power as it rolls across Cuba. Top sustained winds are now at 105 miles per hour. Meanwhile, few details have emerged from Jamaica after the hurricane smashed into that island yesterday. Top winds were 185 miles per hour. Musical artists say that streaming services are posting new songs that are said to be from them, but that they never made. That's because the songs were created by artificial intelligence. The songs mostly target smaller artists. NPR's Bobby Allen reports that while there are guardrails to protect top musicians, indie bands or artists who've died are more susceptible.
I talked to people inside the music industry, other musicians, producers, and record label people, and they all said, yes, this is a growing problem. Earlier this year, Wilco singer Jeff Tweedy's former band had an AI song pop up on its Spotify page. The country music singer Blaze Foley, who died in 1989, had a new AI song appear. It's happening more and more. And Spotify, when I reached out to them, said, you know, they're building new defenses against this. They said they took down 75 million spammy songs last year, and many of them were made with AI.
NPR's Bobby Allen reporting. A family in Australia says it has found a bottle with historic messages inside. The messages were written during World War I by two Australian soldiers. The soldiers were going to the battlefield in France. They wrote optimistically about life aboard their ship. The letters they wrote were dated in August 1916. I'm Korva Coleman, NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include the Cy Sims Foundation. Since 1985, supporting advances in science, education, and the arts towards a fairer, more just, and civil society. More information is available at cysimsfoundation.org.
Welcome back to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. Thanks for joining us. Our election coverage continues, and today we're focusing on a major development in the ongoing fight to protect voter privacy and election integrity. This week, the League of Women Voters of New York State, joined by the Campaign Legal Center and the Brennan Center for Justice, filed a motion to intervene in a lawsuit brought by the U.S. Department of Justice. The DOJ is seeking access to New York's complete voter registration database, including sensitive personal information like driver's licenses and partial Social Security numbers, information that is not typically public and that voting rights advocates say the federal government has no legitimate reason to collect. Joining us live now to talk about this, Erica Smitka, Executive Director of the League of Women Voters of New York State, one of the organizations leading this effort to protect voters' privacy and the integrity of our elections. Erica, thank you for joining us.
Hi, thanks so much for having me.
Can you tell us why the League of Women Voters of New York decided to step into this lawsuit?
Absolutely. So, you know, the League has been working for 100 years to really protect the rights of voters. And we work tirelessly across New York State to educate voters every single election cycle and to register voters. And when we register voters, this is one of the things that we sometimes mention to them. If they have questions about the security of the data that they're handing over, we relay New York State law, which is that their information is safe and it is secure. You know, as you said, there's really no justification for the federal government to demand this access to sensitive voter information under the guise of election security. The data that they'd be receiving does not give them a complete enough picture to do what they are claiming to want to do with it, which is they are claiming that they want to make sure that states are doing their due diligence to ensure that their voter rolls are cleaned. That is, by, you know, federal law and state law, that is the role of the state. The federal government should play no role in that process. So all that these actions are doing are just eroding public trust and ultimately undermining our democracy.
Is that what worries you most about the DOJ trying to get access to voters' personal information?
So I think there's a few things that worry me. There are a few things that we suspect the DOJ may do with this information. We think that we know that they may potentially use this information to further promote false claims about election fraud. This is something that this administration has said time and time again, even though there have been many studies that have proven otherwise, that there is no large-scale election fraud that has affected the outcome of, here in New York State, outcome of any election. We think that they might use this to target political opponents. They may use this to attempt to force states to remove voters from the rolls based on incomplete information. So what I mean there is if they have, for example, someone's driver's license number, that information doesn't give them enough to know that, this person may have moved 3 months ago to Massachusetts and they need to be removed from the rolls. That person may not have gotten around to applying for a new license, right? So they just simply don't have enough information to say whether or not a voter should stay on the rolls. All this would be doing is giving them access to this private information. And then the last thing that, we're concerned about is we know that they are working in conjunction with the Department of Homeland Security. And they, you know, we know that the potential to use this for immigration enforcement is very likely. And that is also something that's of great concern to us.
This filing, which was on October 24th, comes on the heels of an earlier motion to intervene on behalf of the League of Women Voters of Maine, where the DOJ is seeking the same data regarding Maine voters. How is voter data already protected here in New York?
Yeah, so voter data is protected in a number of different ways. It's protected by state law and by federal law. So there is state election law that that says that there is a statewide voter registration list that's maintained by the State Board of Elections, and only authorized personnel have access to this list. And that, you know, voters' information is protected in that way. There are also a few pieces of federal legislation that that protect voters' data here, one of them just being the Privacy Act. So we know that the way that the DOJ has gone about this may violate federal and state privacy laws. Two of the pieces of legislation that they are invoking is the National Voter Registration Act and the Help America Vote Act, saying that that gives them the right to step in this instance, when in reality, both of those pieces of law and legislation fully authorize the states to have control over voter databases, and does not ever authorize broad access by the federal government to full voter databases, or does not require the release of particularly sensitive information about individuals.
And could this kind of request from the DOJ shake people's trust in our elections? I think I know the answer.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, especially in today's day and age when, you know, data breaches are becoming more and more common. And so if I'm a new voter and I'm hearing that my data may be at risk of going where I don't expect it to go, that's of course going to make me more hesitant to register to vote. For folks who are, given the administration's collaboration with the Department of Homeland Security, we know that this may make folks less likely to show up to the polls, to go out and vote. But ultimately, what it does is it just continues to sow that distrust in our election process and in the safety and security of our election process. Which I want to reiterate while I'm here, our elections are run extremely well. Particularly here in New York State, they are absolutely safe and secure. And the League has a number of different resources on our website to highlight, you know, exactly what happens to your ballot from point A to point Z.
We talk a lot about it on this show about personal data and how scammers misuse it. If this data were misused, how could it affect everyday voters?
Absolutely. It kind of, again, goes back to sowing that distrust. There's no guarantee. This would be this would be the first time that the federal government, if they were to be successful in all these different states, they've asked for data from, you know, we know at least 40 different states so far. So were they to amass this kind of federal database of all of this voter information, we know that the likelihood of this data being targeted by hackers is, or even just disclosed to the wrong person or to someone who doesn't have, who isn't authorized to access that information. We know that this data is kind of a prime target for that type of, for that type of hacking. And so it, again, is going to make voters less likely to want to participate in the process. And our democracy only works when each and every voter and each and every person in our community has equal access to the polls and equal access to having their voice be heard.
I mentioned that you joined other groups to join in this motion. Where do things stand with the motion? It was just filed on the 24th, Friday. How are you working with these other groups to make sure voters' privacy is protected?
Sure. So, you know, we are at a bit of a standstill with the case as we're still experiencing a government shutdown. So it's kind of a wait and see at this moment. But the League is consistently working in collaboration and in coalition with other good government groups and voting rights groups across the state on voter issues each and every day. And so that's everything from educating voters and knowing, you know, ensuring that they know exactly, what they need to know before they head to the polls. And it's also work just like this. So whether it be another legal effort or whether it be seeing, you know, how can we approach this differently to ensure that we maintain this sense of confidence in our system and we continue to get people excited to be engaged in the process of democracy.
What do you want New Yorkers to take away from the league's legal action?
I'd like New Yorkers to know that, you know, that the league is here. We are doing the work, rain or shine. We are showing up in your communities. We are showing up to do, you know, voter registration drives, to do community education events. We're showing up on a statewide level, working on voter protection legislation or, you know, working on the federal level on lawsuits just like this. So I think that's what I would like for folks to take away the fact that, you know, the league is here in collaboration with many other groups working to do this work and to protect the rights of voters everywhere. And that, you know, if you have a question about anything, always feel free to reach out to your local League of Women Voters or to the state. And we won't stop doing this work, right? We will continue to do this work to ensure that our democracy stays strong.
That's Erica Smitka, Executive Director, League of Women Voters of New York State. There's more information at their website, lwv.org. Also, more information, voter information you need and election information you need from vote411.org. That's brought to you by the League of Women Voters Education Fund, and you can access that at our website, wjffradio.org. Erica, thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having me.
We'll take a break, and when we come back, Damascus EMS is seeing more 911 calls and fewer volunteers, and potential Medicaid cuts could make things even harder. We'll hear what's at stake for local emergency response next. This is Radio Chatskill.
Next time on City Arts and Lectures, Jelani Cobb, Dean of Columbia Journalism School and a staff writer at The New Yorker. He'll talk about the current state of journalism and offer an insider's perspective on relations between universities and the Trump administration. That's next time on City Arts and Lectures on this public radio station.
City Arts and Lectures, Sunday afternoon at 4 on Radio Catskill.
Something wicked this way comes.
Something wickedly delicious.
Apple Pie Paloozaween.
A spooktacular fundraiser for Radio Catskill.
Grab a slice or take home a whole pie. Or enter your pie in our baking contest at WJFFradio.org.
If you dare.
2 to 5 Saturday afternoon at Catskill Brewery, Livingston Manor.
Costumes encouraged at Apple Pie Paloozaween.
You're listening to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. Damascus Volunteer Ambulance Corps in Wayne County in northeast Pennsylvania has reported a 14% increase in emergency calls this year. But as its volunteer numbers dwindle and expected Medicaid cuts are on the horizon, EMS operators are worried about how the mostly volunteer-led organization will continue to serve residents in the coming years. Radio Catskill's Kimberly Izar spoke with John Tucci and Mike Bruce of the Damascus Township Volunteer Ambulance Corps to learn what challenges lie ahead.
Come around here.
Inside the large white ambulance, John Tucci shows me inside one of two medical vehicles used to serve residents in case of an emergency.
We have another radio system there. We have all our supplies that we need within reach of the EMTs. In onboard oxygen, in addition to the one that's on the stretcher.
And then how many people are typically in here?
Well, on a BLS run, you'll have a driver and an EMT, unless we're training someone.
Tucci is president of the Damascus Township Volunteer Ambulance Corps. It's a volunteer-led emergency service organization serving Damascus and several other townships in Wayne County, Pennsylvania. They also service parts of the Catskills, including Tustin, through mutual aid calls.
It's basic life support. We're here to expeditiously get you to, major medical care. There are times that we have to go beyond Wayne, and we have to go to Geising, a CMC. Scranton, Lehigh Valley is another hospital that we might use. And it's all dependent upon the patient's needs. That's paramount, and what the EMT or the paramedic decide.
Batucci says the number of calls the Damascus Volunteer EMS Corps gets is far beyond their capacity.
Call volume has gone up. Year-to-date last year for 2024 was 331. Year-to-date this year was 382.
That's a 14% increase in emergency calls from 2024 to 2025. And this year is not yet over. Mike Bruce, an EMT with Damascus EMS, shared more about how the spike in emergency calls adds pressure to a mostly volunteer-led organization.
Usually the calls are going up maybe 10 to 15% a year. Probably during COVID, that was probably when our call volume was at its least, because everyone was staying at home. But since COVID, our area has grown in populace because we have a lot of new residents that moved out of the urban areas and moved north. And it started out as second homes, but now they're migrating here. And that also puts a toll on our calls. The problem is when they come from those large areas where they have ambulance services and they know they're going to come out, and they have a hospital almost on every corner or within 2 or 3 miles from where they live. Now they're in an area where if they're not in Honesdale, and like Damascus, Pleasant Mount area, and Equinox, we're at least 20 to 25 miles away from any type of healthcare.
Plus, Damascus EMS volunteers respond to mutual aid calls, meaning calls outside of their immediate service area if another township or village needs additional support.
We respond and give mutual aid more than we've ever taken it. I don't think to date we've had to request mutual aid. We have one dedicated crew, 24/7, 365, always. And there's a second call, second crew, when the first crew is out. We've been able to muster, you know, a crew for that second call, which is not scheduled.
One of their biggest challenges? Making sure they have enough volunteers to help, especially recruiting younger volunteers.
How many volunteers do you have now, and how does that differ from what it's looked like in previous years?
What would you say, 18 to 20?
Yeah. Okay. I don't know. I couldn't imagine the inactive ones. Unless it's our holiday dinner, then we have about 60 members.
Yeah. Everyone shows up.
Exactly. Yeah, it's a free meal. It's a good time.
So it's roughly 18 to 20 active volunteers now. Are you trying to actively recruit right now?
Constantly. We're very fortunate. Within the last month, we had Mike and Jordan, and the captain interviewed a couple. Yep. That are looking to come on board. They're already certified.
With our recent new members, they're older. They're in their 40s and their 50s. Okay. Some people say, well, that's not old. But the thing is how many years are they going to be around for the Corps? We don't have a lot of 18, 19, 20-year-olds volunteering. Because a lot of us are boomers that are members, and we're from that thing where we would come together and help things. Oh, look at your service clubs, your Elks, your Moose, the Lions Club. If you see all their members sitting at their tables looking for they're in their 60s, 70s, some of them are 80s. Our average age is maybe, if we had to average out our 50s, 40s to 50s.
One thing I was reading was that some people are like, well, one way you can bring on new volunteers is by paying them. And I'm curious if you think that would mitigate some of those challenges or not really.
It's not. It does mitigate some of the problems, and it's not. We're not adherent to that, but going over my notes, dwindling volunteers, high cost of training and equipment. The state doesn't really provide any like free training. So somebody has to bear the costs, whether it's the individual agency or through a grant. That's the money that we would get from the state if we get a grant. But there's a high cost to that. there's competition from the page between the paid jobs. Who can pay more? Naturally, a volunteer organization is not going to have the wherewithal of a commercial entity like Penn Med or Cottage Ambulance. And the quality of care is going to be the same. It doesn't change with the rate of pay.
Some of the some of the younger members, they'll be EMTs with us, and then they decide, okay, well, I'm going to go to college or some sort of a trade school or something like that. And they say, I'm tired of being in this area, and they'll move out and they'll never come back.
The other biggest challenge Tucci says the ambulance corps is facing is having enough money in the bank.
People and money. I hate to put it as frankly and succinct as that, but it's people and money. We need the people, dedicated people, and we need funding. Those are paramount, you know, and we need quality people, dedicated people, and we need a revenue stream, at least some money coming in to keep the Corps active and working. We have to watch our pennies.
Like other volunteer EMS providers, Damascus EMS is funded by several revenue streams, like insurance billing, donations, tax revenue, and grants. But Bruce worries that it may not be enough.
And how can an organization that's doing 400 calls a year, though we do billing, with the way billing is, we're only getting 50% of what we bill out, because that's what the Medicare rates are about 50-55% of billable that they'll actually pay out that we're agreeing to accept. And of that 55, you only get like 80% of it. So it even goes down further. Medicaid, depending on the state, the reimbursement rate is even lower.
And with looming federal health care cuts, there's growing concern amongst EMS providers about the future of how rural volunteer ambulance providers will continue.
We don't know where we're going to be in 2 to 3 years. If we can get through the year with still money in our bank and people to ride in the seat, we're going to say that's a good year. But when you say 2 to 3 years, we go, your guess is as good as mine. Because we don't know. You have a shutdown right now with the government. You have two political parties who hate each other. And they're making their decisions not on the needs of the people who put them in office, but I don't like you. And then it's a trickle-down effect.
Exactly.
We don't have that problem, so to speak, but the thing is the people who are responsible for their constituents, they don't think about us.
Bruce says that Damascus EMS is always looking for volunteers.
We're tied to the community, and the community is tied to us. I think a lot of the people in our community, they respect us, but they wouldn't want to do our job. And that's unfortunate. Maybe we're doing our job too much and they don't think we need help, but we do.
In Damascus, I'm Kimberly Izar for Radio Catskill.
We'll take a break, and when we come back, NYU's College of Dentistry and the Center for Discovery team up again. We'll learn why this partnership matters and who it's helping. Next, this is Radio Catskill.
Support comes from Catskill's Property Care, offering full property care year-round for commercial and residential properties in Sullivan County, including snow plowing, landscaping, property checkups, and more. Information at CatskillsPropertyCare.com. And from the Calicoon Theater, an updated vintage movie theater with new film releases, live music, and more. CalicoonTheater.com. And from listeners like you, who donate at WJFFradio.org.
I'm Maria Hinojosa. This week on Latino USA, Jorge and Paula Ramos, a conversation with journalists and father-daughter duo about why neutrality is failing journalists in the second Trump administration.
Neutrality doesn't work nowadays, especially when it comes to the way our immigrants, people like me, are being treated.
That's this week on Latino USA. Thursday afternoon at 2 on Radio Catskill.
This week in This American Life. As of this year, refugees are basically not allowed into the United States, except for one lucky group.
Oh, yeah. No, we're all coming over. No, we'll see you soon.
Wow.
On our way, around the corner.
Winners, and how they made themselves winners. We get to know them. That's this week.
This American Life, Saturday night at 6 on Radio Catskill.
You're listening to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. Dental care is one of the most unmet health needs for children and young adults with disabilities. Families often struggle to find providers who accept their insurance or who are trained to support sensory and behavioral needs in the dental chair. This week in Sullivan County, a team from NYU's College of Dentistry is on site at the Center for Discovery, bringing exams, x-rays, and preventative care directly to the people who need it most at no cost to families. It's the fifth time NYU has set up this pop-up clinic, building trust and long-term comfort with these dental visits. Joining us today are Eddie Rosenbaum, Director of Global Outreach and International Engagements at NYU Dentistry, and Carrie Mazurek, Chief of Education, Curriculum Design, and Coordination at the Center for Discovery. Thank you both for being here.
Good morning. Thank you for having us.
Thank you for having us.
Eddie, let's start with the big picture. Why is dental care such an unmet and urgent need for children and young adults with disabilities?
Well, throughout the United States and globally, dental care and access to dental care is always a barrier. But specifically with this population, there's an added barrier to access to care. So within our programs for the global outreach, we go to different communities domestically and internationally, and we've been able to create a framework that is behavioral and has sensory frameworks to, in order to treat this population and be able to kind of break down some of those barriers. So we're able to set up in any type of classroom setting to bring a team of dentists, dental students, and residents who have been trained in this framework to be able to provide care to this population that many times have been waiting months, if not years, to see a dentist in the first place. So with us, we're able to bring all the supplies that we have from New York City out to different communities and see patients where they're at the school. They don't have to take time off work. As long as the parents provide the consent forms, there's no out-of-pocket cost for our programs.
Carrie, this marks the fifth time NYU Dentistry has brought the clinic to the center. How did this partnership between NYU and the Center for Discovery begin?
Sure. As far as I'm aware, I think NYU had a connection to Dr. Lane Spadola, who is one of our treating dentists that work out of our Discovery Health Clinic. And I think through conversations with her, there was an opportunity created, and then they connected with me. I met with my team here, and we were able to really put all the protocols and systems in place to really create an opportunity that serves. I think each trip we've had between 50 and 75 students seen over the course of 3 days. So it's really an incredible experience and opportunity for our students.
Eddie, for people with disabilities, routine dental appointments can feel overwhelming. How do your teams adapt the environment and communication to support these sensory and behavioral needs?
Yeah, so before we arrive, we send out consent forms as well as behavioral and sensory intake forms. So before the patient even arrives in our pop-up clinic, we're able to review their chart to see what kind of music they like to listen to, what are some of their preferences in terms of seeing care, what is the best way to give praise. We have a variety of different tools that we use to help to regulate the patients. So this can be a variety of different tools. We have noise-canceling headphones. We have weighted vests. We have fidget toys. There's a variety of different things that we use for each patient and tailor it to their needs. So we work with a full team here. So we have a team that we come from NYU Dentistry, but we're working with a TCFD team who knows these patients very well. We're working with the behavioral analyst, teacher's aides, the teachers. We work together to see each patient where they're at.
And I think I would jump in just to share that aside from the time that the NYU team is here, we've also coordinated opportunities for our team, which includes our OT, PT, speech, behavior analysts, teachers, teacher associates, and any other team members nursing who are interested in supporting, so they can also practice all of the experiences that a student might have when the NYU team comes here. So they've left specific tools for us to be able to help students get familiar with just by touching them, manipulating them, sometimes putting them in their mouth, sometimes just touching them is enough exposure until the dental team arrives. So it's really been a year-long practice opportunity and then a lot of coordination with the families on the back end in terms of practice as well.
Yeah, because it's not just like, you know, you have a dental appointment and then, you know, 6 months or a year later, you go again. Right. This is for these this population, the contact that you're talking about makes them more comfortable with oral healthcare over time, right?
Yes, and most of our students have a lot of sensory issues that make them resistant to having someone, you know, even a toothbrush in their mouth can be a challenge for them. So this repeated opportunity to practice is something that has been really changing the way they view that dental appointment. We have students who hop right in the chair now and open their mouth and are able to actually take x-rays while they're here, which, you know, 2 years ago, I don't think that I would be considering some of the students for that level of intervention at this point. So it's been really amazing.
Because dentistry is very invasive. you know, it really puts you in a vulnerable situation. You have to get out of your chair, sit into a dental chair, lean back, open your mouth to somebody who you just met. So there's a lot going on. But when you're able to kind of break it down in smaller bits and make the patients more comfortable, it allows them to build that trust with the provider to get to the point where they can self-regulate, and then you can work on providing more care time after time. So it's about building those relationships, and we try to come twice a year, so bringing the same team so that patients who are coming to see, they start to recognize us and feel more comfortable to kind of build up to the next stage of oral health care.
Full disclosure, dentist visit, not my favorite thing either. So, Carrie, I appreciate that you are aware, Eddie. Carrie, what's the response been from families, Carrie, and the folks that are receiving the care and also the staff at the Center for Discovery of this opportunity with NYU Dentistry?
From the family perspective, it's been wildly very, very appreciated. You know, as Eddie mentioned in the beginning, getting an appointment just to see a dentist for students, even for some of us, right, is usually a long wait period. And then when you add on the anxiety of having to bring a child who is resistant to going to the dentist to begin with, those can really create a lot of stress for families. So knowing that this can happen within the school environment with people who are trained and can really support the students in a very caring and compassionate way has made the parents feel so much better. You know, I will say, and Eddie and I have also talked about this, there is still the overarching challenge of more invasive and, you know, needed dental care for extractions or fillings or some of those things that require sedation that our parents still struggle with. So it's been nice to have this connection because we are trying to problem solve through some of those challenges and see if there is a way that we can help parents find the right access to the services that they need. And for the most part, unfortunately, that is down in New York City or Westchester or other areas. Our local clinic certainly has the ability to do some more minor interventions. So that's been a way that we've been able to link families up with some of our dentists here. But I think overall, the families are really thrilled with the experience that they've had so far. And our teachers and clinical teams are really excited about the fact that they are seeing such progress over such a short period of time. Just from their first visit to the second visit, we saw huge growth for students' acceptance of some of the tools in their mouth and some of the interventions that the dentists were doing, whether that was cleaning of their teeth or just being able to really look in and do some scaling in some situations as well. So everyone is really really happy that this relationship has been forged and looking forward to improving access to dental care for this population in the future.
And do you see improvements in overall well-being when these oral health needs are being met?
Yes, 100%. Because a lot of the students that have come through the clinic, there were several students where issues were identified, and some of those were able to be resolved through dental appointments and clinics that we were able to support. So definitely has been a lot of improvement in the behavioral challenges. Awareness, you know, we have some students who we would say, you know, they're really not eating as much as they used to, or they seem to be really sensitive when we're, you know, doing toothbrushing, and through the clinic identifying areas in their mouth that really needed attention, and then being able to guide them to the correct intervention has been fantastic.
Eddie, and NYU Dentistry has been training students to care for people with disabilities since the 1970s. I think you even opened a dedicated clinic in 2019. How are you preparing the next generation of dentists to serve these folks with disabilities? And is there a path for expanding this type of model to get more accessible dental care for folks?
Yes, absolutely. And the problem is, when you get into rural areas or even after graduation, there's not a lot of dentists who feel like they've been specialized to work with the population. So immediately they try to refer out. What we're trying to do is create a model that's very accessible and affordable for dental students to realize that they have the skills within them to treat this population, and they feel more comfortable, and they're going to be willing to take on these patients in the future. And giving them that exposure now builds up their confidence completely. So we've actually replicated the model that we've used here at TCFD at a public school in La Romana. We've also done it in upstate Maine, La Romana, Dominican Republic. And then we've also done it in Chile, in Santiago as well. So we've been working with very diverse populations, but using the same model. And it's been working really well. So we're trying to expand this to make it more accessible to other dental universities, so this becomes more of the standard and not just a one-off special event.
Yeah.
And what I would say, you know, the team that has come here, then they're not always the exact same students. Each year there are different students, but they are enthusiastic, they are compassionate, they are just hungry to learn how best to serve this population. And I think that's also been incredibly refreshing for us.
And Eddie, I would just ask also, in terms of, you know, professionals, future dentists, or even others who want to advocate for more accessible dental care across all populations, what would you say to them?
Yeah, so at NYU Dentistry, we have the Oral Health Center for People with Disability, and they're incredible in, with the work they're doing for advocacy. So they actually even take a group of students to Washington, D.C. to learn about how they could advocate for disability rights, and we're working to make people realize how important these issues are and how forgotten this community has been. So we're getting as many people exposed to ways they can get involved, ways that are accessible and adaptable for their career path to inspire them to work with this population.
And if listeners want to learn more about the work you're doing or support it, where can they go? Really for both of you. Eddie?
For our programs, you can check the NYU Dentistry website. If you go to NYU Dentistry Global Outreach, you'll see a little bit more about the work we do, the communities we work with, and some pictures and videos of the outreach programs we work on.
And similarly for the Center for Discovery, our webpage is thecenterfordiscovery.org.
Well, thank you for being here. That's Carrie Mazurek, Chief of Education, Curriculum Design and Coordination at the Center for Discovery, and Eddie Rosenbaum, Director of Global Outreach and International Engagements at NYU Dentistry. NYU Dentistry is on site at the Center for Discovery today and for the next 3 days, bringing preventative care, x-rays, exams to folks who need it most. And again, at no cost to the families. Thank you guys for being here and for sharing this work that you're doing for the folks at the center and beyond.
Thank you so much for taking the time. We think it's really important, and I'm glad that you've reached out to be able to do this.
Yeah, thank you for helping to spread the word.
You're welcome. All right, we'll take a break, and when we come back, we'll learn more about the strange, beautiful world of Mia Brownell's art. Got it there, finally. This is Radio Catskill.
Radio Catskill, keeping Pennsylvania voters connected. Election day is Tuesday. Polls are open in Pennsylvania from 7 a.m. to 8 p.m. County boards of elections must receive all mail-in ballots by the time polls close. If you've already submitted a mail-in or absentee ballot, you cannot vote at the polls. Find your polling place at pa.gov or vote411.org and access all of Radio Catskill's election coverage at wjffradio.org.
American democracy is one of the oldest democracies in the world.
On the next Radio Lab.
It's kind of like a laptop from 1985.
Does democracy need an update?
Corporate money, special interest lobbyists,
the weirdness of the electoral college,
the two-party system in general,
gerrymandering,
and
active voter suppression,
and minority groups who don't get a voice. There's a lot to fix, right?
We imagine what a new democracy might look like on the next Radio Lab.
Today at 2 on Radio Catskill.
You're listening to Radio Catskill. I'm Tim Bruno. Painter Mia Brownell brings a fresh twist to the still life tradition, blending the realism of 17th century Dutch masters with microscopic forms of molecular imaging. Brownell's work, alongside pieces by Kat Chamberlain and Lexa Walsh, will be featured in a new exhibition at Catskill Art Space in Livingston Manor from this Saturday through December 28th. Visitors will hear directly from the artists during a talk on Saturday from 3 to 4, followed by a reception at 5. Radio Catskill's culture reporter Valerie Manzi spoke with Mia about her influences, the science within her art, and what audiences can expect from the show.
Today on Catskill, we'll hear from one of the three artists exhibiting new works at the Catskill Art Space in Livingston Manor. The opening is on November 1st. That's a Saturday. There'll be an artist talk at 3 and a reception at 4. The artists include Mia Brownell, Kate Chamberlain, and Lexa Walsh. Today we'll hear from Mia Brownell. Welcome, Mia.
Hi. Hi, Valerie. Happy to be here.
Well, I'm happy to be interviewing you. I, of course, looked at your work and I found it to be very sumptuous and intriguing.
Thank you. That's very kind.
There's something in there that is happening that I can't quite describe. Now, your work is still life, but it's not traditional still life.
Correct. So I deeply appreciate your reaction and interpretation. The work is very labor-intensive. I'm beyond excited to be sharing these paintings, most of them for the very first time in Livingston Manor. Should I just give a little bit of background?
Of course. The areas you are exploring are so intriguing and almost counterintuitive in some ways.
Yeah,
but then become, oh yeah, this makes sense. So tell us a little bit about your work.
Okay, I'll try. So yes, I've been painting for quite some time, and like you noticed, I incorporate aspects of still life, and in many ways, I'm trying to use the conventions of the painted food still life to paint about food. And this work really started, gosh, years ago when I wanted to expose the cliche, you are what you eat, because eating, right, is the most profound relationship that we have with nature. It's this intersection with so many things, right? It's an intersection with our body image, other species, the industrialized food complex, science, the environment, everything. And in the work, and the way there is that sort of polarity in the work is that because I'm fascinated by both the visible and invisible aspects of food. So I engage the visible by painting in a very traditional observational way. And then I'm engaging the invisible, one, by thinking about the cultural and social aspects of food. And then maybe more importantly for my interests, I'm engaging the invisible by thinking about what's happening underneath the surface of our foods, thinking about food in terms of its physiology, its genetic structure. I have become so very interested in the biochemistry of things, in the way the biochemistry of our food merges with the biochemistry of our bodies when we eat. So with that said, at this point in my practice, all of my designs and compositions are inspired by, you know, scientific models of proteins and macromolecules, DNA, and amino acids. And one of the things that are so special about proteins, right, they're in all living organisms. They're, you know, in the hand that's holding the apple and in the apple that's about to be eaten. So all of these things, what's so interesting on a microscopic level, they actually all move and spiral and fold onto themselves. So that movement of all of these things on a microscopic level, that movement is something I try to capture in the painting as well. Does that make sense?
Yes, it does. It does. Having okay. looked at your work, I found some of your titles interesting. Still Life in the Autumn Sun, Still Life with Woman Waiting.
Waiting, right.
Still Life of Fruit of the Vine, and Still Life of Microplastics, Still Life of Bioplastics.
That's right.
Tell us a little about those.
Okay, which one should I start with? I could, you mentioned the sunflower
yes,
first.
That's fine.
So this Still Life with Autumn Sun is my second sort of major sunflower painting, really just a painting about the love of sunflowers, and it's an homage to two of my favorite painters of sunflowers. That is Gerald Cooper and Egon Schiele. In fact, the title comes from a sunflower painting by Egon Schiele. So it's kind of like this homage to them, this love for sunflowers. My neighbor always plants sunflowers like every season, and they're so amazing, right? They're anthropomorphic. They're emotional. You see the entire life cycle in the entire season. That sort of awe, it's something I also tried to capture, but probably failed, but try to capture in the painting as well.
It's not a traditional painting of a sunflower. You take it to another level.
Right, correct. Because again, like just part of my practice is also thinking about the proteins in those sunflowers, right? And that sort of spiral composition that's in on the canvas is inspired by that as well. So there is multi things happening in there. And I've been introduced a kind of narrative to capture the idea of autumn sun. And there's kind of this unique sort of cloud shelf that I've incorporated into the design as well.
I also was very taken with Fruit of the Vine.
Yeah, so that's sort of a new thing that I'm really excited to share about these paintings that sort of reflect the ideas of wine. I think I'm not alone in trying to make sense of some of the madness and excess that we've been witnessing from some of our political leaders in the United States. And so trying to understand, found myself reflecting on those like ancient Greek and Roman festivals of Bacchanalia. And these were festivals that worshiped the god of Bacchus, right? The god of wine, intoxication, madness, and excess. And so I thought that these festivals might make for a relevant metaphorical import into the painting. And what's so interesting is that I've been painting grapes and fruit for decades, and mostly because of the formal overlap that grapes have with molecular structures. But I've never actually painted about wine. And so this shift has opened up some really interesting and new narratives in my process, including the introduction of lip traces inspired by lipstick on a wine glass.
I saw that.
Yeah, yeah.
I was intrigued by that as well.
Yeah. Yeah.
And at first I didn't know what it was, and then I looked and looked, and then I saw it.
It's very, very subtle, and it took me a while to figure out how to paint them effectively. And so these marks, these lip marks could be, you know, lipstick, it could be marks of wine or even blood. And what's so, you know, it's all kind of new for me, so I'm still trying to figure everything out. But, you know, lipstick on a wine glass, that lip trace, sort of suggest a very feminine moment, right? Mm-hmm. That lipstick on a glass is sort of a historical record of sorts, and you know, multiple lip traces suggest many moments, or many moments of waiting, or many moments of trying to access what's inside of the glass. In my case, in some of these paintings, there are these glass vessels, and if you look closely, there's no meaningful way to access the liquid that's inside. So.
Your website is also filled with so much of your work that is so interesting and informative. I was also interested in some of your previous exhibits, Food Physics, Delightful, Delicious, Disgusting, Stomach Acid Dreams. What's it all about? And your father is a
biophysicist. So my body of work, and it has been extensive, and I appreciate you so much taking the time to look at the website, because it does catalog the years that I've been investigating this kind of imagery. You know, I was really fortunate. I was raised by two truly incredible people, and I believe they're coming to the opening on November 1st. I'm just kind of a synthesis of their interests. My mother is a sculptor, and my father is this well-known biophysicist. He discovered electromotility in the hair cell and the inner ear in the 80s, and it's been really pivotal research to helping the world understand how we hear.
Was he nominated for a Nobel?
Yes, he was. A couple of times, yes. I think if they ever decide to offer the award in hearing, I have a feeling he would be a serious contender, yeah.
Is there anything else you'd like to add before we conclude?
Thank you so much for reaching out, Valerie. I really appreciate the time, and thank you to your listeners hanging out for a few minutes. And I hope to see some people at the opening on the first.
Thanks to culture reporter Valerie Manzi for that. And there's more information about the exhibit at CatskillArtSpace.org. That'll do it for this edition of Radio Chatskill. Before we go, a reminder that Apple Pie Palooza-ween, our big event, is coming up Saturday at Catskill Brewery in Livingston Manor. It is, again, something we've been doing for the last few years. And if you want to enter the baking contest, you can go to wjffradio.org and maybe get the crown of best apple pie in town. Otherwise, you could just buy pie and eat pie. That's Saturday at the Catskill Brewery, Livingston Manor, from 2 to 5. More information at wjffradio.org. I'm Tim Bruno. Thanks for listening.
Support for Radio Catskill comes from the Narrowsburg Union and Catskills Curated, presenting products of regional artists, artisans, makers, and craftsmen. Gift wrapping and shipping available on site. NarrowsburgUnion.com. The Cooperage Project in Honesdale, dedicated to building community through performance, learning, markets, and good times. TheCooperageProject.org. And from listeners like you who donate at WJFFradio.org.
I'm Jason Tugaw, host of The Mixtape. This Friday's show falls on Halloween. You know what that means. Goth Dance Party. Favorites from the likes of The Cure, Susie and the Banshees, and Love and Rockets, along with subterranean tracks creeping up from the underworld. 7 p.m. Friday night, Radio Catskill.
Something wicked this way comes.
Something wickedly delicious.
Apple Pie Palooza-ween.
A spooktacular fundraiser for Radio Catskill.
Grab a slice or take home a whole pie. Or enter your pie in our baking contest at WJFFradio.org.
If you dare.
2 to 5 Saturday afternoon at Catskill Brewery, Livingston Manor.
Costumes encouraged at Apple Pie Palooza-ween.
You're listening to Radio Catskill, local news, culture, and NPR. Today's forecast, a mix of clouds and sun. A jacket might come in handy today. Cooler, a high 49. mostly cloudy and breezy tonight with a little rain and a low of 41. Now, rain, some heavy, will affect the area from tomorrow morning into early tomorrow evening, and also a shower or two possible on Friday, Halloween. Tomorrow's high 52, low 44. Friday's high 47, and again, very windy for Halloween. On Point is next.
WJFF Jeffersonville. You're listening to Radio Catskill, local news, culture, and NPR.